Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being with us. We got a couple hours of engaging conversation for you today. We're not going to be taking calls these hours. We're just going to engage in, a little deeper exploration of some ideas. Second hour, Layla Miller will be here to talk about preserving innocence in children. Maybe a particularly poignant idea here at this time of year, where there's all the toys and movies and all that kind of stuff, but something that's pressing 365 days a year nowadays. So that will be, we really look forward to that conversation. I hope you'll hang around for that. This hour, we talk Advent, maybe the most confusing liturgical season. I don't know, the one by which the most contradictory things are said, probably. But to help us to discuss Advent, Dr. Christopher Bloom, who is a professor of history and philosophy at the Augustine Institute in Denver, Colorado, where he also serves as academic dean. He is also the general editor of the brand new 12th grade apologetics series of books, Why Believe? Answers to Life's Questions. His latest book is a collection of meditations for Advent and Christmas by Blessed John Henry Newman. It's entitled Waiting for Christ. Dr. Christopher Bloom, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cy. Great to be here.
Okay, so what is Advent? What am I supposed to do?
Yes, that's right. So the name comes from the Latin, of course, towards the coming. So we are setting aside something like a month. It could be as long as 28 days. It could be as short as 21 days before Christmas to prepare for the coming of the Lord. And as I'm sure all Catholics know, there's a twofold preparation here. It's a preparation to remember Christ's coming as a babe in arms in Bethlehem, and also to anticipate Christ's coming at the end of time.
So is it a penitential season, just of expectancy, a joy? How are we supposed to comport ourselves?
Yes, this is a great challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
So in one sense, it is penitential. The liturgy signals that by omitting the Gloria in the Mass and in the Liturgy of Hours, omitting the Te Deum hymn, of course, also the purple vestments, right? And there is certainly an appropriate penitential cast here, with prayer, fasting, and almsgiving having their proper role in that. But it's a less penitential season than Lent, mm-hmm. Where the focus really is on, of course, Christ's passion that we are preparing to commemorate. And so that really deepens our commitment there to the penitential time of the season. I think the way that Newman approaches it in his sermons is by stressing the theme of vigilance. So he's got a sermon on watching. He's got another one on waiting, thus the title of this collection. And as we think about what that looks like in our lives, you know, maybe we're waking up a little bit earlier in the morning. It's dark outside. We light a candle. Maybe we're staying up later at night after the kids are asleep to prayer for a time of prayer. Whatever fits our life, that's maybe where that penance for the season ends up getting located for a lot of us, I think.
And so these meditations that you have collected here in Waiting for Christ, meditations for Advent and Christmas, do you mean, or did you intend as the editor to make them each day take one during the course of the season?
Exactly. Yeah. So the table of contents, for listeners who can't see the book, the table of contents is actually according to the days of the month from November 30th down through January 6th. So it really is a one day at a time. And what I did was to go into Newman's sermons. We have a little over 200 of his sermons that were published and remain today. And to choose, of course, initially just to get Advent sermons from him and Christmas sermons from him. But then once that ran out, to choose sermons that would accentuate those Advent themes and then subsequently the Christmas themes that the liturgy presents to us.
Now, when I think of the writings of John Henry Newman, I always think of now I'm going to forget the exact name of it, but it's the meditation on the mental sufferings of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
He just sees in the passion of Christ in a way that other I've just never seen anyone write about it like John Henry Newman. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about who he is and why, as a preacher and writer, he is so powerful.
That's a great question, Si. Of course, that particular meditation won't be in this volume.
No, of course not.
I'm hoping it will be in the companion volume for Lent and Easter.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. So give us a year and we'll take care of that. That's a great question. So, of course, there's partly divine gift here that's just mysterious to us. And then we can try to answer that question based on what we know about his life. So Newman's life unfolds from 1801 to 1890. Right in the middle of his life, he converted and joined the Catholic Church in 1845. Those first 44 or so years of his life, he was firmly in the sort of the bosom, if you will, of the Church of England. He, as a teenager, he went up to Oxford, which at the time was really a seminary. And probably half of his fellow students, like him, were preparing for holy orders and to be a minister in the Church of England. For many of those young men in that, you know, we're looking here, 1816, 1820, that period, this is the time of Jane Austen's novels, right? This is a married priesthood, if you will. And as we know from Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice, many of them were very worldly and comfortable.
Yes.
And were, you know, the Church of England provided a steady career for them. And good enough men, but not very apostolic. Newman had been touched by grace in his teens and had a conversion that is generally spoken of as a kind of conversion to evangelical Christianity. An intense life of prayer. So he's in the Church of England, okay, but the Church of England is having a certain kind of contact with the spirit of John Wesley's Methodism and a kind of little bit of that radical Protestantism that we associate with Wesley. Going back to the text of the gospel, fastening onto the person of Jesus. Really being devoted to prayer. And that's where Newman was, 1818 through, let's say, 1830, something like that. And so he's a young man teaching in Oxford. He's ordained. He's taking care of the religious life of the students who are under his custody. And he's rubbing shoulders with older men who are priests in the Church of England. And he's figuring out how to be a teacher. And this experience is throwing him into the Church Fathers. And it's deepening his understanding of Christianity. So that after 1830, Newman is kind of leaving behind this evangelical strain. In fact, distancing himself decisively from Martin Luther's theology. Increasingly calling himself a Catholic, using a small C, you know, and then becomes a leader in something called the Oxford Movement, which is a reform movement within the Church of England centered on this seminary that Oxford was between 1832 and 1845. And the short version of that story is to say Newman and his friends tried to make the Church of England more Catholic, more faithful to the tradition, and they were kind of spit out as a body spits out, you know, foreign particles, you know, the Church of England just kind of rejected this reform movement. And so Newman and some 200 other ministers of the Church of England converted to the Catholic Church between about 1843 and 1855.
And a good part of that reform, that Oxford reform, was a sense that there needed to be liturgy, that liturgy needed to be, because Anglicanism had become somewhat non-liturgical. Is that correct?
That's right. Non-liturgical, maybe in two different ways, either in the kind of Mr. Collins way, in which the liturgy was just rote repetition.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, beautiful enough, but not very inspiring. Or on the evangelical wing of the Church of England, non-liturgical because now becoming more Lutheran, as it were, right? All of the emphasis is placed upon the sermon. So what Newman and his friends are doing is discovering the breadth and the depth of Catholic liturgical piety. So, for instance, even in the 1830s, really early 1830s, really breathing life into Matins and Vespers, the Liturgy of the Hours. And of course, the Anglicans are going to call it Evensong with that wonderful style they have.
Yeah. Right.
And then subsequently, as we move a little closer to where the Oxford movement hits the reefs, many of the members of the Oxford movement are ministers. You know, they think of themselves as priests. They are praying the breviary of the Catholic Church every day. So they really were, had a deep liturgical piety.
So it was natural. It was a natural next step in a certain sense to come into full communion with the Catholic Church.
Exactly. Exactly.
I want to ask you more about Newman in 1845 and becoming a Catholic, what that would have meant in his context, and then why we call him blessed. But we have to take a quick break, so we'll do that. We'll take a very quick break here. As we discuss Advent through the writings and the mind of John Henry Newman with Dr. Christopher Bloom, more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
A very blessed Advent to you and yours. Thanks so much for being with us. Advent is our discussion point this hour. We have Dr. Christopher Bloom, historian and educator and academic dean at the Augustine Institute and the editor of a brand new and beautiful volume of meditations from John Henry Newman on Advent and Christmas. The book is called Waiting for Christ. You can probably get it on Amazon or I'm told the Augustine Institute might be sold out. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but you can get it at the Ignatius Press still. Is that correct?
Yes, we've ordered a lot more copies.
Oh, okay.
They should be in just a few days.
Oh, then okay. All right, very good. Well, then from the Augustine Institute, you can check there on their website and get your copy of Waiting for Christ, Meditations for Advent and Christmas. We're talking about the author of these meditations, Blessed John Henry Newman, a very important figure in the early 1800s Anglican Church, who came into the Catholic Church 1845 and became a towering figure in the Catholic Church. Is that all a fair description of?
I think so.
Cardinal Newman.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What is it like then for him to come into the Catholic Church in 1845? Because, I mean, being a Catholic in England at that time is still not a socially prestigious, let's say, thing to do.
That is an understatement.
Okay, fair enough.
So, yes, a couple of highlights from the mid-19th century. One of the lowbrow bestsellers of 1851 or thereabouts was Maria Monk, which was, let's just say, not a happy story from the Catholic perspective. And also in 1850, when the Catholic hierarchy was reestablished, before that they had missionary bishops who did not declare themselves to have dioceses. Okay.
Okay.
And then in 1850, you have a hierarchy reestablished with a bishop of here, a bishop of there, and so on, right? Which is kind of in your face to the Anglicans. The Pope, Pius IX, was burned in effigy up and down the land.
Oh, man, that hurts.
Oh, yeah. No, it was tough. And the basic, what's fundamentally at stake here is that for the Englishman proper in 1845, to be Catholic is to be Irish.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Okay, I see. Yes, right.
Just simply.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really just that simple. So there's a few Englishmen who are Catholics, but nobody really knows them, and they're hidden away here and there, and they don't make any noise. But England, thanks to the nastiness of England during the potato famine, which is not a topic that is a happy one at all, Irish are fleeing Ireland, mostly for America, but many of them are coming to England. So there's a lot of immigrants. There's that whole tension between the host country and immigrants. To convert to the Catholic Church is a bit like saying, I don't want to be an Englishman anymore. I want to identify with these hated immigrants. It was really quite something. And then Newman, to sort of see and raise you, as it were, he had the choice to be a very prominent, high-class priest in London, and instead decided to stay in Birmingham and minister to Irish immigrants throughout his priesthood. And he chose a hidden life with a non-illustrious congregation. Very noble.
Really, yes. And so, but he still maintains a life as a writer.
Yes.
So the meditations in the book, Waiting for Christ, are they all from sermons that he preached, or are they from other writings?
They are all from sermons that he preached. I would say 80% of them or more are from his Anglican years, and then the balance from his Catholic years.
Okay, so what is he like as a preacher? What do we know about him as a preacher?
Well, that's a great question. He gave Anglican sermons as to length, so he read them, and they took 45 to 50 minutes for him to read.
Wow.
He was not at all demonstrative in his performance. In fact, it was apparently somewhat difficult to hear him. So people would sit towards the front.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it was from that experience of straining to hear him that the legend arose, or maybe it's just because his prose is so lyrical and so musical, and his psychological insights are so deep. But he had a following. On Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m., he would give these sermons all through the 1830s, and it was kind of legendary. So if you were a serious young man at Oxford, you were taking your studies seriously, you were preparing for the priesthood, you went to these sermons. And as the Oxford movement went on, it became almost kind of a political statement to go to these sermons, because this man who's giving these beautiful sermons was also writing theological tracts, calling for the Church of England to embrace its Catholic tradition.
And did he maintain, while he's this, now he's a Catholic priest, and of course that's a liturgical role, the sacrament central to his life, and I'm sure to his ministry among the Irish there in England. But did he maintain that kind of immediate evangelical kind of thing that he had gotten from John Wesley and the Methodists?
I would say so. Yeah, I think so. And I think you see it now. There are much fewer sermons from his Catholic days for the very reason that you point out, that most now he's giving homilies within the context of a mass. And so he's not writing them out, and they're not that long. Mm-hmm. And so his Catholic sermons tend to be for more special occasions, or they tend to be to private audiences of one kind or another. But in those Catholic sermons, we see that same focus on the person of Christ. We hear the writers of the Gospels and St. Paul speaking to us, right? I mean, he's always so close to the text of the New Testament. And I think that's where you see his roots in the kind of evangelical revival.
So who is Christ for him then? I guess if you titled the book Waiting for Christ, and who does this, you know, former Anglican, or well, in many cases here, still an Anglican, who does this Englishman Christian believe Christ is, and how you relate to Christ?
Oh, that's wonderful. So, Christ, of course, first and foremost, is God. And so many of these sermons here are asking originally the hearer, now us, the reader, to contemplate the astonishing mystery of God's condescension. So prominent here is the hymn to Christ from Philippians 2. Prominent are emphases on how Christ, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, in taking on human nature, does so with sovereign freedom, right? He doesn't need anything from the earth. He comes bearing gifts, not needing anything. And he therefore, when he humbles himself by being born in a stable, by being born in an obscure village, he is showing us the depths of God's love for the human race. So that's right at the center here. There's a tremendous amount of attention in these sermons and elsewhere in Newman to Christ as a model of meekness, as a model of detachment from comfort, as a model of apostolic zeal. And then a slightly different theme also present here. Christ is our king. We are his servants. We are waiting for his order. We want to know from him his will so that we may do it. These are the prominent themes there.
So in the, as we follow you then through the meditations, what were you trying to, order these in a way that led people to exactly that person by December 25th, and then kind of allowed that to radiate through the Epiphany? Or how did you decide about ordering them?
I'll just take what you said. That's fantastic.
Oh, well, that's the way I would have done it.
Yeah, that's great. So the thing about these, you can't miss Christ in the sermons of John Henry Newman. So so that's easy, right? He's always preaching Christ, and there's always some aspect of Christ that's put before us. So there's no missing the mark there. So what I did was to take the period, the first 2.5 weeks of Advent, and to locate there the sermons that especially ask us to watch, to wait, to repent, to reckon with the awesome mystery of Christ coming. Then in the 8 days immediately leading up to Christmas, the days of the O Antiphons, I chose sermons that take us a little bit closer to Bethlehem, in which Newman is asking us to focus on Christ as our King who is coming, who's going to establish a kingdom, who's going to give us a work to do in that kingdom. And then, of course, with the Christmas days, 24th and 25th, I cheated and put 2 Christmas sermons in. and so here we are contemplating the newborn Christ with great joy. Really just kind of following the liturgy there, the 26th, 27th, 28th, with sermons for the feasts of Stephen, John, and the Holy Innocents. Then the last days of December, really preparing for New Year's resolution is what I had in my mind.
Uh-huh.
So sermons about looking back and looking ahead. And then a Marian sermon for the octave day of January 1st. And then those 5 days there in January as we prepare for Epiphany, my goal there was to get sermons that would stir us to really commit to a beautiful new year of grace and the work that new year gives to us.
So it's a journey toward Christ and with Christ. Then, we got to take a quick break. I'll ask you about the role of the saints and worship and Mary and why he wants us to be reverent towards Jesus. All those questions as we continue our Advent journey and hopefully embrace Blessed John Henry Newman and his help for us on that journey. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Christopher Bloom right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Advent is upon us and Christmas approaches. Catholic Answers wants you to know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter the promo code CALIVE18 at checkout. With great new products on doctrine, church history, morality, apologetics, and much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to shop.catholic.com today to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code CALIVE18 at checkout and save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humani Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humani Vitae. We asked 5 distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humani Vitae from 5 perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and coworkers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Monday on Mortal Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A very blessed Advent to you and yours. We're discussing Advent this hour with Dr. Christopher Bloom from the Augustine Institute. His latest work, an edited edition of sermons from Blessed John Henry Newman called Waiting for Christ, Meditations for Advent and Christmas. And I highly recommend you get it. There's probably no exposure to John Henry Newman that will not profit you in one way or another. So whenever you get the chance. But we have 2 John Newmans. This is often confusing to people.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the Bishop of Philadelphia in the early 19th century, and of course, if you see his name and you know German, you would say Neumann, yeah. Right? But he himself asked for people to pronounce his name Newman because he wanted to conform to the American speech patterns. And he was a great man, sort of the founder of the Catholic school system in the United States, but a very different sort of man from John Henry Newman.
But are they rough contemporaries?
Roughly, they overlapped for sure. But our John Newman was a little older.
Mm-hmm. And now he's blessed. How long has he been since he's been beatified? When was he beatified?
I want to say 2011. The canonization could be soon. A second miracle has just been reported in Chicago, no less.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
A woman who was suffering from a life-threatening condition during a pregnancy, that condition has disappeared upon his intercession. So, wow.
That's praise God. Praise God. Well, I want to get back to the meditation, but I do want to ask you something real quick. You said he lived kind of a hidden life there among the Irish Catholics in Birmingham,
yes,
England. But he does rise to the princely stature in the church.
That's right. How and why does that happen?
Yeah.
Really two extraordinarily significant achievements during his Catholic life. Okay, the first is that he is asked to go over to Ireland to found a Catholic university in Dublin, which is something of a success and something of a failure from an institutional point of view, but it did give him the occasion to give a series of public discourses on education that were subsequently published under the title The Idea of a University, which is probably his best known work.
Yeah.
And it's really a kind of immortal work of the Catholic educational philosophy. So that was a very highly significant work. And then, interestingly, a few years later, he was publicly the subject of calumny and some very scurrilous letters accusing him of duplicity were published in the London Times or one of these other papers. And he sensed that it was necessary for him to reply in public because, of course, so many people had joined him in converting to the Catholic Church that he thought if he left these accusations unanswered, it would weaken, quite possibly the commitment of these people to remaining Catholic. So he wrote something of an autobiography, I think you would call it. You'd put it in that genre. It has a Latin title, The Apologia Pro Vita Sua, Apology for His Own Life. And it's a remarkable work. It was an instant bestseller in England and has been regarded as one of the most significant theological works of the 19th century ever since. So those two works kind of bring him out of hiding, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many other things that he wrote, but his day job, so to speak, was saying Mass and hearing confessions.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. It was something he stayed faithful to throughout his life. Now, so that will bring me to one of your meditations. I want to ask you about a few specifically. Mm-hmm. Here is a line, a title on December 1st, Worship, a Preparation for Christ's Coming. Tell us about that, will you please?
Good. So maybe just as a prelude here, what I would say is that each one of these meditations, Sai, represents about one third of the original sermon. So I wouldn't want the listeners to be afraid it's going to take them 45 minutes to read one of these meditations. probably only about 10 minutes. And so what I've done is to try to take a kernel here from the sermon and present it in such a way as to take us deeper into the season. Here, what he's doing in this part of the homily is reflecting upon the typical weather of Advent season, which of course is late autumn from an astronomical point of view or a meteorological point of view. And he's evoking here the darkness of the time of year and the frost and rain and so forth. And in this particular instance, he's looking at Advent as a time of preparation for the second coming. And so the end of the year from a meteorological point of view, all things are dying and the year is entering into the sweep of winter. Reminds us that we too shall die, but that we, of course, have a Savior who beckons us to life after death. And the title there, Worship, is in effect, this is what we're supposed to recommit ourselves to at this time of year, to remember our creaturely status, and that because God is our creator and our father and our king and Lord, that our absolutely most proper posture towards him is one of worship.
If I may share, I'm sure you hear this all the time. One of the critiques of our kind of post 60s and 70s Catholic Church is that worship itself is sometimes compromised by entertainment and that kind of thing. And maybe the word we hear a lot is people desiring a greater reverence in worship. And you have a chapter from a sermon here on reverence. What does John Henry Newman tell us about reverence?
Good. Oh, I really appreciate your keying on these words here, because it's very true that our ear for the English language is a little bit different from his. And so I think that's one of the good things about reading Newman, is it reminds us of what certain words actually mean, right? So yes. Worship derives from worth-ship, and it has to do with our recognizing the awesome dignity of God. He's quite literally better than us. And reverence, of course, is similar, right? To revere something properly is to admire it, to recognize that it's somehow set apart as better. And this sermon here, he's looking at the fear of the Lord, godly fear, as appropriate to us. And of course, as with any great Christian writer, he's not interested in calling us to abject fear. Mm-hmm. If we are in a state of sin, we might experience some abject fear, and that's a good thing. But if we're not in a state of sin, then what we should be cultivating is a filial fear, the fear of a loving son or daughter towards a father, a fear of displeasing him. That's more, you know, we don't expect to displease him, but we're, as it were, alert, because we want to act in such a way as to please him. And that's what's going on here. This sermon is remarkable for a passage, a kind of characteristic Newman turn. There's a long paragraph in which he tries to paint for us a portrait of what it's like for us to wait for a friend who's not present, or how we speak of a friend who's not present in his absence, and how surprised we would be if he were to show up while we were speaking of him. which very surprised, no doubt, right? He's taking a psychological turn, and this is really his gift. You were asking earlier in the hour about what is it that sets him apart as a preacher, as a writer of sermons.
Yeah.
And what I would say is, here it is. This is a man who, when he was in his, all through his 20s, he's teaching Aristotle's ethics and Greek to undergraduates, which is to say, he's thinking about human character in its principles, and he's helping students understand dramatic situations that confront human beings by working through these tragedies. And he has this kind of literary genius for a certain kind of highly compressed storytelling. And that's what we're seeing in this sermon and elsewhere.
We're talking about we're talking about Blessed John Henry Newman. Dr. Christopher Bloom has organized some of his sermons in edited form to be readable for each morning or night throughout Advent and the first part of the Christmas season. Waiting for Christ, Meditations for Advent and Christmas is the book. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk a bit more. I do want to get to the role of Mary and the saints in our Waiting for Christ and some of the other things that John Henry Newman has to teach us about this time of expectancy and waiting. We'll be right back with more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Why do we need Catholic radio? Because not everybody's sitting in front of a computer or watching their television set at home. How about when driving to work? Catholic radio's there for you. I may be a Catholic priest, but I'm still a student of the faith. And Catholic radio helps supply good material, whether it be a question and answer format show, whether it be a show itself on doctrine or theology. I myself, as a priest, am always learning.
Father Wade thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Waiting for Christ. That's what we're doing now in this Advent season. He's already, I guess you could think of it metaphorically a bit like the Holy Family. He's already there with them, but they are still waiting for him expectantly. Meditations for Advent and Christmas is the subtitle of the book Waiting for Christ. Each of them is a meditation from Blessed John Henry Newman. They have been edited and organized by our guest, Dr. Christopher Bloom, who is the Dean of Students. Is that right? Dean of Students at Augustine Institute?
More like Dean of Academics.
Dean of Academics. I apologize. Yep. And also a historian and professor and many, many good things. Okay. So we were talking a little bit about worship and reverence and the way that John Henry Newman commends them to us as we prepare for the coming of Christ. There are a good number of pieces in here that are reflections on particular saints, and there's it's funny how they're reflections on particular saints, but as departure points really for him to make these larger points. What does he see as the role of the saints in our lives, and why does he pick so many of them to talk about?
Well, I may have confused you a little bit because I put certain saints in the chapter titles that Newman wouldn't have even known about.
Oh, I see. So that's why I gotcha.
Yes, because we celebrate their feast days during Advent. So, for instance, St. Juan Diego, December 9th,
of course
canonized long after Newman's death. So, but I'm glad you point that out because we wouldn't want readers to be confused. But what I did with those sermons is try to pick Newman's themes that somehow spoke to the saints whom we know and love.
Yes.
So the sermon Divine Calls seemed appropriate for Juan Diego, who truly had a divine call. But as you mentioned, there are sermons that Newman gave on the saints, on saint days. So in this volume, we've got one on St. Andrew, one on St. Stephen, one on St. John, one on the Holy Innocents, and three on Our Lady.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to take Our Lady first, he takes a very high Christological look at Our Lady in each of these sermons, right? So it's this is not too surprising for a man whose Marian piety had to be shoved under a rug for the first half of his life. When he becomes a Catholic and he can really embrace the great mystery of Mary and rejoice in God's work in the Virgin Mary, he gives some sermons on the Blessed Mother that are just exquisite. So these passages are from sermons during his Catholic years, and they are really focusing on the fittingness of the various gifts that Mary received as being the Mother of Christ, right? So her preservation from original sin, especially. So that is really his focus there. With the saints, these are sermons from his Anglican years, and so rather than particularly pointing us to the intercession of the saints, it's really the saints as moral exemplars. So in the case of St. Andrew, this beautiful feast day that's always either just before Advent, as this year, or just after Advent has started. He, of course, is already thinking about Advent when he's writing and giving this sermon. And he presents to us Andrew as someone who introduces other people to Christ. He introduces St. Peter to Christ. And that's a wonderful role for us sort of ordinary Catholics to imagine ourselves fulfilling. And what he's doing in this sermon is helping us to understand just how weighty and glorious that role is, even if it seems very hidden and insignificant. Then in the St. Stephen homily, of course, St. Stephen's feast day is the day after Christmas.
Right.
And this is one of those great shocks to the system for a Catholic. You know, we've just had this beautiful, you know, frankly, sentimental commemoration of the newborn king.
Yep.
And then the very next day, we're called to martyrdom. So this is an amazing thing. And Newman rises to the occasion in that sermon with a reflection upon seeing this world as something of an obstacle
yes.
to our union with God.
A particularly one that I imagine many people on December 21st will get to. We get reports of, and I think any normal human being knows that has any interaction with the world today knows that there's a kind of epidemic of loneliness in the world, having to do with our society having been atomized in many ways. The title is just powerfully attractive. The Church, a Home for the Lonely. What is he talking about there?
He's talking about how the Church offers for us, how to put it here. I mean, he doesn't explore the subject through metaphor other than the metaphor of home. But in effect, what he's pointing out is that the Church shows us how to live in the same way that the guardrails on a highway keep us from falling off the highway into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, right.
You know,
at least so far they have.
And so the things that he says in this sermon, they're very consoling. He speaks of the need which mankind lies under of some shelter, refuge, rest, home, or sanctuary from the outward world. And the shelter or secret place which God has provided for them in Christ. So here it's sort of the Church as the place where we find truth, where we find our North Star, you know, our ability to navigate the troubles of this world. And that's one way of thinking about Christ, right? He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And we need a way to follow. We need a truth that grounds us so that we're steady. And it's in the Church that we meet Christ and find that.
And so, of course, the great day itself, Christmas, the theme is joy. What does he have to tell us about joy?
Both of the homilies that I chose for the 24th, Equanimity, and the 25th, focus on joy. And he's asking us to hold together in a wonderful sort of Chestertonian paradox, the joy that we have that Christ is coming with a kind of fear of doing wrong, a fear of disappointing him, a godly fear, as he says here. So let me just read a line from Newman. When we are told both to fear and to rejoice, we learn that our joy is not to be irreverent, nor our fear to be desponding, that both feelings are to remain, but neither is to be what it would be by itself. And I find this very helpful because, you know, we're commanded to joy, to rejoice, you know, on Gaudete Sunday, for instance, and by various other hymns and antiphons and so forth of the Christmas season. And sometimes, of course, it's quite hard for us to rejoice. And it's hard for many people to rejoice in the holidays because perhaps, you know, it's a widow who's
yes.
lost her husband, or perhaps it's a young person who, for purposes of a job, is living in a city far away from his family. It can be a very hard time of year. And so Newman is kind of frank and honest about what this command to joy looks like. And so he says things like this: the lesson of joy which the incarnation gives us is as impressive as the lesson of humility. So he links together our religious sense of why this feast day is so beautiful, that God has become a tiny little baby for us, with, of course, all of the festivity that is appropriate for the time.
So joy is not just that's interesting. What grabbed me and what you just said most was the idea of it not joy not being irreverent, that there's a joy is a really, truly, fully human thing. It's not just a lightness, a temporary lightness that comes over us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And joy is really a tough one because it is both an emotion.
Yeah.
You know, when our favorite player hits that ball over the fence, right? We have the emotion of joy.
And
we all know what that feels like. And that's just tremendous, right? That's one of God's gifts to us. But there's a deeper joy, which is not in our emotions. It's not spurred by some sense perception, like a home run. Rather, it's a disposition of our will. And it's meant to be steady. Right, it's not meant to be that the sort of spike of an emotional high. It's meant to be an abiding connection to the cause of our joy.
Yes. Okay. So, as you said, it's a. I hadn't thought about it before. That Saint Stephen, the next day, the martyr. I'm going to skip the martyrdom for today because I want to ask you, about relations with friends and family, because that's another big one for this season. And that comes 2 days after Christmas, maybe when we're tired of friends and family. I don't know if that's why you put it there.
Well, that was his homily for the Feast of St. John in one year or other. And that was the theme that he chose because, of course, St. John, as we know, at the end of his life, he just said over and over again to anybody who would listen to him, my children love one another, right? And when we go and we read St. John's epistles, they're full of that message that we need to express our love of God through our love of neighbor. And I think it's true. It can be a real trial in the holidays to deal with the rigors of extended family living, which we otherwise during the year might not. So it's great to have that little meditation there. Here's the thing that's interesting about Newman. The theme of love is not a prominent one in his sermons. This really struck me as I was preparing the book here and looking at all of his sermons. Didn't read every one of them, but I certainly looked at them all, looking for the right themes for the season. And he seems to have been able to take it more or less for granted that his Christian listeners in the 19th century understood that the gospel is a message of love of God, of love of neighbor. What he thought they didn't understand very well is that the gospel is a message of faith and a message, a call to living the virtues of faith and hope, and thus seeing our charity transformed by our faith and hope. And I think that this particular sermon is a very beautiful sermon on the gratitude that we have for family and for friends and the love that naturally flows from that gratitude. But within the context of the whole book, I think we have a strong sense that this impulse to charity is spurred by our readiness to do God's will.
Well, that's a lovely place to leave it. Love is usually a good, it's a good sign if you end on love as a topic and faith and how faith forms our love. The book is Waiting for Christ, Meditations for Advent and Christmas. The editor is Dr. Christopher Bloom, who has been our guest. Blessed John Henry Newman is the author of each of these meditations. Get the book. And if you need fine books and materials like Why Believe for high school students, lessons in apologetics, go to the Augustine Institute. They're just a wonderful group, and you won't be sorry you did. Dr. Bloom, thanks so much for sharing some of Advent with us.
Thank you, Si.
We'll see you next hour with Layla Miller on Catholic Answers Live.